CJSF is practicing social distancing, so this episode was produced remotely.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Community radio from Simon Fraser University, broadcasting on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Coquitlam, Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish. My name is Jesse, broadcasting from home today. As usual, it's February 11th, this Thursday morning. It's cold out. Not snowing here. Maybe later in the day, who knows? It's cold enough for it. Hope you're having a good morning so far. Today on the show, we'll be hearing recording of a talk recorded by SFU's Department of Gender Studies and Women's Studies. Graduate Sonia Boone came to speak about her memoirs, What the Oceans Remember, dealing with her family history spanning Europe, Africa, Southeast Asia, South America, and North America. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there. Sonia reads from her latest work. And What the Oceans Remember, as I mentioned, and talks about a bunch of other stuff. So we'll get to that. We'll have a little bit of music first and a little bit of music after, but that's going to take up the bulk of the show. So let's get right into the first musical selection of the day by Tanya Iyer. This is I Forget to Drink Water, and then in parentheses, Balance.
Shorts.
Forget to Drink Water by Tanya Ayer. Here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And now we're going to get into the bulk of the show, which is, as I mentioned, a talk by Sonia Boone about her memoirs, What the Oceans Remember, presented by SFU's Department of Gender Studies and Women's Studies. So thank you to them for making this available. And without anything else, let's get right into it.
It is my great pleasure to welcome Sonia Boone back to SFU, where she was our very first PhD graduate in Women's Studies. And she has gone on to do amazing work and is currently a professor of gender studies at Memorial University. She is a prolific author of many books and scholarly articles on feminist theory, life writing, autoethnography, and women's history. And she has also published an impressive slate of creative nonfiction, which is a talent that I think we see on ample display in this beautiful book that we just read together. So please join me in welcoming Sonia Boone.
Thank you so much. It's so exciting to be back at SFU, and I really wish I could actually be back on the mountain with you. And I've been thinking back to our student room, gathering together and chatting about all sorts of things. I'm greetings from St. John's, or I am now St. John's, Newfoundland, and I live and work on the ancestral homelands of the Mi'kmaq and the Beothuk here. And congratulations on 50 years. It's a really exciting milestone to hit. I came in 2004 and you took a real chance on me because I didn't have a lot of background at all, zero. And it was really a remarkable 4 years that I spent at SFU. And so it's really nice to be back as well. So Helen asked me to just share a little bit about the book and then read an excerpt as well. And so given that it's a slightly more academic audience, it seemed like a good idea to talk a little bit about some of the motivations behind the book itself and the kinds of things that I was holding sort of front and center, theoretically, conceptually as well. So to me, the book isn't just about entangled histories within my own family, but about larger questions of what it means to live in the shadows of those histories and how we live in the afterlives of these histories. And I wanted to share a quote by Camille Turner, who's a visual artist and scholar, founder of the Afronautic Research Lab in Toronto. And she was interviewed by CBC Newfoundland and Labrador a few years ago. And she's talking about the histories, what she's dealing with, histories of slavery. And she said, you know, we didn't create this history. None of us did. We weren't here, but it's what shaped us. And by not dealing with it, we can never move on from here. We can't really move into a future where things are equitable. So I think it's really important to acknowledge these stories. And I think that's part of what I was looking at too, is what are those stories and what do they mean today? And so to me, the book stitches together a number of things, different threads. And so my love of archival research, which started before my PhD when I was playing historical flutes and continued through my PhD working with Mary Lynn Stewart and has continued ever since. My love of life writing, autoethnography, autobiography, the ways that our lives are always already enmeshed in political, social, cultural, historical frameworks. And the personal is always and has always been political. And from the personal, you're able to draw out bigger pictures from the personal. Certainly my love for feminist theory, which my first feminist theory class was with Helen way back when. And then I took another one with Mary Lynn afterwards. And I was really interested in this book in really thinking about contact zone and thinking about the shoreline itself as a contact zone, thinking about what happens at the space where water and the oceans that transported so many of my ancestors, where the oceans meet the land on which they labor and on which they lived. And so this notion of the contact zone as a mud, as a muddy space that's neither solid nor liquid. And what does that mean in terms of mixture? What does that mean in terms of what does mud mean in terms of understanding who people are and who they become in spaces of mixture, but also what might mud mean in terms of scholarly traditions that still seek to separate out here, histories of slavery here, histories of indenture here, European history here, other history here. What does mean when actually you try to work across those spaces a little bit more? What Lisa Lowe has called the intimacies of four continents, which some of you have probably read. So that was interesting to me as well. When I was writing the book, I was thinking about a number of things. One, I'm more and more interested in thinking about how we share research, how we choose to write about our work, who we choose to write it for, and why. So I'm less and less interested in traditional scholarly venues. And I'm completely uninterested in boring writing. And I'm sure some of you, if you're assigning, if you're teaching and you assign work, you try to avoid that writing too, if you can. because why should we, why is, we do so much exciting research. Why does it turn into this dry husk of boringness when we try to read it afterwards? So that's something that's very interesting, to, important to me. I was also really interested in politics of citation in a number of ways, because in my, in this case, the story exists in fragments. How do I make sure those fragments remain the center of the story without getting overwhelmed by the apparatus of scholarly writing, right? So how could I create a citational framework actually physically in the book that would not overwhelm what was going on, but also which scholars and writers and thinkers did I want to situate my work in relation to and why? But then I was also interested in speculation. That was, I think, my final thing, was interested as I was working with fragments, how can speculation be used as a way of reading, as a way of thinking, as a way of writing? What can speculation do? So those are the kinds of things that were underpinning and burbling all the way through. And so I wanted to share a bit of the book from the second half of the book. And this is a part where I really have to deal with speculation because there's almost nothing left. So this is the part where it deals with my great-grandfather, Sahatu, and his mother, Jurai, when they arrived in Suriname in 1874. And there's really almost no archival record left. There is an immigration record. There are a couple of newspaper notices and death records, and that is literally all that remains. And so I am engaging in some speculation in this particular section of the book. So I'll start reading that from that section. And it's a little bit, if for people who have read it, you'll notice that I skip little sections here and there because, well, because that's the way it works best in terms of reading it. So I'd first encountered Jurai and Sahatu online in immigration records included in the digital archives of the Dutch National Archives in Hague. Jurai's immigration record states that she was 1.513 meters tall and donkerbruin, dark brown, in complexion. She was Hindu, and according to the transcribed record, she hailed from the village of Arbhapuri in the district of Faizabad in the north of India. She and her son were sent to one of the largest sugar plantations in the colony, the Nederlandse Handelmaatschappij owned Resolutie, where she lived and worked for 5 years. In January 1880, by then mother to three children, one of whom died in infancy, and partnered with a Chinese goldsmith and merchant named Uasai, Jurai Rada was granted leave to stay in the colony. That record, desperately short on details, is almost all that remains of her story. Like the majority of her compatriots, she left nothing in her own words. Sahatu, meanwhile, is equally silent. According to family lore, he was illiterate and never wanted his photo taken. It's almost as if he deliberately silenced himself, hiding away from any possibility of later revelation. The past is remembered and told by desire, writes Laura Edith Savoy, and so it was that in the absence of a rich archival record, I began to create stories for Jurai Rada, exploring different scenarios, plotting a range of different adventures. In one version of her story, Jurai and her husband travel together, a hopeful young couple looking to better their situation in the world. But tragedy struck, and he died somehow, at the immigration depot, perhaps, or on the train, leaving a grieving widow and son. In another version of the story, she was already a widow, a woman in mourning who left her older children with her husband's family and took the youngest, too young to leave behind, to start a new life. In yet another version, she fled her village, desperate to escape a violent household, or perhaps she was an orphan, abandoned on the street, a girl who found some measure of economic security in sex work before signing on for a Caribbean adventure, lured by the promise of healthcare, housing, and regular pay in an apparently Edenic location where she could rebuild herself. In my worst dream, she was a victim of capitalist enterprise, grabbed as she was walking down a dirt path, then dragged to a depot by a greedy agent looking for women to meet his gender quota. In this version of the story, she was held against her will, her child in her arms, their futures hazy and uncertain. But what if all the stories I created for her were wrong? What if there was nothing sympathetic about Jurai Rada at all? What if Jurai was a grasping schemer? What if she was dangerous? What if she lied? What if she was mean, cruel even? What if she was abusive? What if I just didn't like her? I imagine Jurai at the train station, head veiled, eyes downcast, hand holding tightly to her small son's arm as she shuffled forward, her body jostling against those of others around her. I imagined the ripe smell of bodies too long in close quarters, of steam and coal, and the heat. Monsoon season was just ending, but it would still have been well over 30 degrees. Was Jurai regretting her decision? Was she afraid? I've taken solo journeys with a toddler. I know exactly how ropey such experiences can be, but I always had a husband at one end of the journey and doting grandparents on the other. I had a passport, and I spoke the languages of security personnel and airport staff. But most of all, I was on holiday. Every time I traveled, I've made completely free choices, and I've always had a secure home to return to. I couldn't bear the thought of Jurai's isolation. No matter how I imagined her, as a single woman with a child, she was an outcast, and she would have been shunned by other immigrants. She was likely illiterate and wouldn't have been able to read the terms of the contract for herself. The immigration agents might have promised her the world. After all, it was in their best interest to recruit as many women as possible. While she might have understood a smattering of English, she wouldn't have understood Dutch at all, and she'd had no adult family with her, no one with whom to share her feelings about the enormity of this journey. She'd been alone. In my best dreams, Jurai had a mother who taught her daughter about life and love. The kitchen is a space of mystery, Jurai, I imagined her saying. You take different elements, one spice at a time, and you bring them to your nose, draw them into your body, pull them down to your toes. Feel them warm you from the inside, and only then can they tell you what they need. I could hear her voice clearly, assured, calm, and confident. You must find love in the heart of ginger, she continued, drawing on lessons she had learned from her own mother before her. Like the man you will marry, the garlic must be young and fresh, with a sharpness that reaches deep into his soul. You will lie together with cumin, peppers, and turmeric, making love on a bed of cilantro. And in my dreams, Jurai loved this husband that her mother had chosen for her with such care. He was everything that you'd said he'd be, Mama, I heard her saying. He was cilantro and garlic, sweetness and bite. Her voice caught, tripping over the comma. And I know that in my dreams, this faithful lover, faceless still, died, leaving his wife, her mother, and her young son to grieve his passing. I know this isn't Jurai's story. It's the one I created for her. I found her a past. I tethered her to something larger than herself. She was no longer C-37. She was a woman with a history, with desires, longings, passions, and motivations. More than this, she was a woman surrounded by love. This story is, of course, much less about Jurai than it is about me. It's not at all about her desires, longings, passions, motivations. It's not about how she understood love. It's the story I can live with. I needed this for her because I couldn't bear to think of her alone. And perhaps I couldn't bear it because I couldn't imagine it for myself. Her life, her complete isolation, was unfathomable to me. And in my version of the story, she was part of something bigger. She had a history, a family, a culture, a palate. She was loved, and she loved. And in my version of the story, it was this love that sustained her. This love that meant that no matter where she was and no matter what happened to her, deep inside herself, she was never alone. I didn't want to see Jurai as a victim of circumstance, her decisions buffeted entirely by forces outside her control. I wanted her to be a free agent, capable of making choices for herself. More than this, I wanted her to have a happy ending.
Thank you, Sonia. That was one of the, I think, for... There were so many wonderful moments in the book, but that particular chapter and the voyage of your great-great-grandmother and her son was so moving. And I felt that isolation that you were trying to grapple with, that you were grappling with. So thank you for reading that and sharing that with us. You've already anticipated some of the questions I have, so I'm not quite sure where to start. But I thought what I'd do is maybe, could we start with the archives? Because that's a particular expertise of yours, and it's not one that all of us might share. And in particular, you have this sentence on page 76 where you say, archives are no place for emotions. You know, leave your emotions at the door, in other words. But to me, they're filled with ghosts, and you talk about the ghosts. They're filled with the stories. They're filled with, you know, living memories in a sense. So I'm wondering if you would take some time to elaborate a little bit more on how you negotiate the archives and the emotions there and in the work that you do. So I'm just interested in exploring that relationship between these very emotional explorations in a place that's supposed to be devoid of emotion.
Well, I love working in archives, and probably anybody else who does knows exactly what that feeling is of going and spending a whole day, a whole week, a whole month in complete silence all day, just with paper. It's one of the most delightful things ever. My husband cannot understand this to save his life. He cannot get it. And there are always emotions when you're working with archival materials. But in some ways, when thinking about training, working in archives, it's also always a sense of, okay, these are the emotions, but here's me. There's the emotions are here, but here's the research. And there's a separation. There's a compartmentalization. And I had certainly encountered materials before where I'd had to stop and think a bit and pull back a bit. But this was the first time where it hit me full on hard, right? And actually what it made me do was really think back to the previous research I'd done and think about how I might actually do that differently now, having done this research, where it really hit me like a wall, like it hit me so hard dealing with stuff where in some cases I had to just stop and everything was just all muddled up. And I just had to, I guess, live with a muddle for a while. And I just wonder if I go back and I look at some of the other stuff that I've done, how would I approach that differently? Because it's not like I didn't think of people, historical subjects, as people, because I always did, but perhaps not to the depth that I did in this particular case, which I don't know if it's actually answering your question.
You don't have to worry about specifically answering my question. It's not a test. You're good.
Anyway, so it's certainly the hardest I was hit with stuff this time than I ever have. So I think for me, that has made me rethink how I approach working with archival materials and in thinking through what my relationship is and thinking through also the role of emotion in terms of thinking about knowledge production, right? Thinking about as a researcher, what is the role of emotion there? So,
okay. So carrying on with that sort of a bit of a through line, you also talk about the ethical responsibilities when you're dealing with the stories of the past. And I'm wondering, based on this experience, if you've changed, you've alluded to that a little bit, if you've changed your approach, or what have you determined are specific ethical responsibilities that you now carry forward in this work? And especially I'm interested in that tension between visibility and invisibility. So, you know, the stories that haven't been told that you're choosing to tell, or maybe you decide not to tell. So kind of if you could share with us your framework for thinking about ethical responsibility with archival stuff now and stories of the past, and how you deal with that. Okay, what am I bringing to light and what may I maybe not?
That's a defense question. I think in some ways, I don't think that there's a black and whiteness to it, because I think it really depends on the context in which you're working and the kinds of things that you're working with and how you're working. I think for me, the big thing around ethical response, two big things for me. One is I'm more and more committed to working, finding ways of working with fragments, right? So in the previous research I did before this, I had all these juicy letters, right? Like letters that were sometimes be 20 pages long with filled with all sorts of goopy details of all sorts of random things. And they were like delights and pleasures to read because there was all this juicy detail. But in this case, I was working with tiny fragments of information, tiny, tiniest fragments. And I think part of that responsibility is thinking about, okay, what stories can fragments tell? Because in some cases, that's all that remains is tiny fragments, right? So for example, when I chose in this book, I chose to list all the people that were enslaved at Sarah Plantation at the moment when the enumerators came around in 1862, the year before abolition of slavery, in the Dutch colonies. And I chose to do that because I wanted to record their names as part of what I was doing, because I knew that in many cases, that's all that remained of them, right? So I, part of that is also thinking through the materiality of lives and trying to find ways of articulating that materiality in my writing as well, right? So it was a very conscious decision to write 314 names down, right? So that's, I think, an ethical responsibility. The other thing is also when I'm working with speculation, what do I see as the limits of speculation? Where can I, if I'm working in a nonfiction framework, how do I make the speculation clear to readers, but also to myself in the process? What is the space between the fragments, right? So if there's a fragment here and one here, what is that space in between? How am I going to fill it? With what kinds of things? And how do I make the fact that I'm filling it clear to whoever's reading it? So those are things that I think are very important to me as I've been, and more important now than perhaps they were before I started this project.
It's so interesting that you mentioned the names, because that was actually one of my questions for you today, is the decision that you made in listing all those names. Because as a reader, I started reading the names, and then I caught myself with the impulse to skim through, and I made myself come back and read every name as you'd written them on the page. So I think that your motivation for listing those names, actually, if readers are paying attention, made us look and read and acknowledge. So a very interesting result, I think.
I actually did that one. I was at a literary festival in Winnipeg, and I'd been invited to read something, and I had chosen something earlier, and then I said, you know, actually, I want to read that section because I want to read all the names. And I asked the organizer, I said, do you think the audience would be up for hearing all the names? And he said, yes, go for it. And so I did. I read all the names. I started the section before, and I read all the names to the end of the section. Wow. Because I felt that that's what I wanted to honor at that particular time.
That's great. I'm just going to pause for a moment to say to everybody, again, thank you all for joining us today. And I have a series of questions that I'll be asking Sonia, but we're inviting you to also share your questions. You can put them in the chat, and my colleague Aman will make sure that I get them so that I'm not kind of looking at two different places. So feel free to put your questions in the chat, and I will come to them at some point. So thank you for that. So Sonia, just continuing with the archives for a moment, and you've said it yourself, you have these letters in your previous work, the letters, and in this case, it was more the fragments, but you still, there's material, there's stuff. And I'm wondering about in our current age, we live with a lot of computerization, we live with technology, a lot of it grows obsolescent. We don't have the things. I mean, even I know I have somewhere in the house a box of letters because that's part of my life experience, a time when people used to write letters. But I don't save my emails the way that I save my letters. And I'm just curious about the impact you think that's going to have on historical research going forward, whether that's, as I said, an academic exercise or even a personal truth-seeking exercise. So what do you see as some of the issues coming up for people such as yourself who enjoy the archival work and bring these critically important stories to light?
First thing is that archives and archival collections and archivists are going to need bigger budgets. that's the first thing that's going to have to happen. On the plus side, making things available, for example, digital archives have made a lot of materials available to people who wouldn't normally be able to reach them, right? So they had, for example, a crowdsourced transcription of the slave registers, the Dutch colonial slave registers, and they, within a very short period of time, within 6 or 8 months, they had transcribed all of them. And now anybody can cab it wherever they are in the world. If they want to look through the slave registers, they can do this online, right? So that is a brilliant thing that's possible. If there are certain materials, like for example, the ship's log for the ship that my great-great-grandmother and great-grandfather came on is too damaged for people to hold. It's 19th century paper, the stuff crumbles as soon as you breathe on it. And so the fact that it's transcribed means that I could see it. I could see it here from my basement in St. John's. And I can't actually physically access it now. On the downside, I think archivists are having a hell of a time trying to figure out how to save all this online stuff. I don't know how they're going to do it. I really don't know how they're going to gather all that stuff and how you, because there's so much stuff, like it's like everything's become immense now, right? Like it's so much. And, you know, even through freedom of information requests that all you get is sincerely in your name because everything else is blocked out. But I have no idea how they're going to do it because it's such an immense job and it's an extremely expensive job as well. So, and they're already overworked and under-resourced. So I don't know that they're going to do it, which is not a satisfactory answer.
Oh, well, no, it just points to a big problem that we're going to be faced with for a while. I'm just going to look at here. There's a couple of questions that come up. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit to the writing. So one of the things, as you alluded to in your opening comments, was that there's academic writing, or there tends to be, and then there's reaching a wider audience, especially in creative ways. So that bringing the research forward in different forms and making it more accessible and available to people who would miss out on great work otherwise. So what was that process for you? How did you unleash your inner creative author's voice to reach that wider audience?
The first thing I did is I signed up for a memoir class through University of Toronto School of Community Studies. So I actually did a certificate in creative writing through entirely online. And I did it online because I thought St. John's is like negative degrees of separation. I had students once who said Sex in the City could never happen in St. John's because everybody knows everybody. So anonymous sex is not possible. And so I thought I can't sign up for a writing class here because it'll be one of my students or someone I know or what, like I just, this, no. So I signed up, I thought I'll go to University of Toronto and we had to introduce ourselves. And then the instructor said, oh, you're in St. John's. Do you know this person? One of my colleagues, right? Instantly. So I took a certificate in creative writing, which helped an awful lot. And the fact this particular book, the first third of it was my final project for that creative writing certificate.
Oh.
And that made a big difference. I also had, through the memoir class, we created a writing group, and the other four people in the writing group were not academics. And so it was interesting running things past them, because at some points they would just be like, can you stop with the questions already? Or I'm bored. I don't need all this detail, right? So it was navigating those kinds of things and having audiences. And one of the, and thinking through like where I was going to put references and all that kind of stuff was having a constant sort of audience that was not academics was actually very useful in that regard because they wouldn't put up with my academic writing.
I just shared a piece of work with some friends and family and I got an email from my sister said, I could read this one. I couldn't read the last one. just following up on that question. So one of the people that you mentioned talking about very few degrees of separation in your book is Cynthia McLeod, the Surinamese novelist. And I found this TED talk that she gives. So in listening to her speak, I learned that it's not Suriname, it's Suriname. Like there's a little accent at the end. Relating to the question, one of the questions from the audience is how does the multilingualism factor into your research? I think that's what they're asking. And how does this register affect differently? So when you're dealing with many different languages and so many different cultures, how does that resonate in your work? How do you navigate it? And does it register affect or differently for you?
It definitely does. So I read in French and English and Dutch is what I can read in. And in this particular instance, I was working mostly with Dutch and English records and feeling languages locate themselves in your body in different sorts of ways. And they evoke sort of different emotions because of where they are in your body and how you feel when you say certain words. There are certain words, as anybody that speaks more than one language knows, there are certain words that are untranslatable. We even know that with the whole trend for Danish hygge, right? Or however you pronounce it, I don't even know, but it's a concept that is untranslatable. It's sort of, and in Dutch, that word is gezellig. Again, it translates as cozy. It doesn't work in English to say it, but it's not cozy. It's something else, right? So there are certain words that link to ways of being and link to culture itself, right? I noticed that actually the question was around, not speaking Stradantongo, which is the Afro-Surinamese Creole. That's a really interesting one because my mother was not allowed to speak it when she was a child. Her brothers were, but the girls were not allowed to speak it. And there are very specific classed connotations to using that particular Creole. There's also an Indo-Surinamese Creole as well that is spoken as well, but the Stradantongo is the most dominant one. So there are certain languages that are inaccessible because they've always been inaccessible, and certain languages that are dominant along the way. Thinking about also how the Dutch words translated into things like slave records in terms of the kinds of names that people were given as well. If I hadn't spoken Dutch, I would have had somebody else to have to translate it for me. I'm rambling a bit here, but I think that there is a sense of the ways that words lodge themselves in your body, and then in relation to that, to your memory as well.
Okay. I just want to clarify that I have been incorporating questions in from the audience, but I see that some are, you'll see them in the chat anyway. So if I do not get to a specific question and you still want it asked, please make sure to reiterate it in the chat. As usual, time is running by really quickly, and I have way more questions, including the ones from the audience. But what I thought, if you wouldn't mind, if we could go back to actually page one of the prologue. And in there, you talk about, given your previous experience in the archives, that you know that there are warnings, but that you forged ahead despite sort of some of the warnings that you were feeling or sensing. And I'm wondering, overall, in the experience of completing this work and now putting it out into the world, what this experience, what you have learned, what are some of the lessons that you've grasped, or maybe even more interestingly, the new questions that have emerged from these oceans that you've traversed and all these currents of times that you've managed?
I think I start with archives being seductive spaces, and I definitely am still in that space. Archives are so seductive in terms of what you want to see there, what is there, what is maybe not there, what you really desperately wish was there, the story that you think you can tell that isn't there. But I wonder more now how to embrace that seduction and how to navigate that seduction. Rather than pushing it entirely away, what does it mean to embrace the seduction of the archives and what they promise and what they may not fulfill? I'm also more, I've already gotten off my beaten path of sort of academic writing, moving in towards more creative nonfiction. And now I'm like, okay, what about if language itself is not enough to tell those stories? What about if we need to move to more artistic forms? I was thinking of Chantal Gibson's work in the poetry book, How She Read, but also in other things. So how that also engages very conceptually, very theoretically with racist past and colonial past, but in a very different sort of form. So I guess how can those seductions be leveraged towards even more artistic kinds of, I guess, I don't want production, I think it's the wrong word, artistic forms of creation, I guess is where I would go with that.
Okay, so, and I think there's, you see that more and more, there's a real interest in, with people coming in and go, you jump around my screens. I'm trying to follow you. It's really interesting to see multimedia kind of approaches to telling stories and sharing information. And so thank you for that. I'm just going to go back to the audience here, a question. I think we've done that one. Near the end of the book. So when you write about that, Matt, and it was fascinating when you were taking the picture in downtown Suriname and the gentleman jumped out and said, don't take that picture. And I'm still a little confused about why he was reluctant to let you take that picture. If it was that he didn't, anyways, but the audience member have said, the interaction very provocative and wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the encounter and what it means to you vis-a-vis the overall experience of this book and family histories and our connections to family histories.
So, I mean, to start off with, when I was there, I tried really hard not to take pictures of people. I was very conscious of trying not to take pictures of people, or if they were so far away that you wouldn't be able to tell who they were. So I was trying to take pictures of landscape, of houses and so on. The reason that people don't necessarily want pictures taken is because of spiritual belief systems around what happens to the photograph and what a photograph does in terms of the relationship between spirits, the house spirits and people and so on. And that's where I would imagine he was coming from, because he was Afro-Surinamese man. But for me, it was such a moment. Like, I was just, when he came running towards me and said, you shouldn't take a picture, it took me aback, and I was so ashamed immediately. Like, it hit me so hard. I was so ashamed. That feeling where you get ashamed and you feel kind of chilled and hot at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so, so uncomfortable. And it really made me stop and think, oh my God, like, what am I doing here? What have I done? Am I just claiming these stories and just grabbing them, being this typical, you know, colonial scholar, hum, chew and swallow and produce. And so is this my story to tell? Whose story is this? What am I doing? And I made to think of all the stuff that, you know, going and picking up fabric at the store and doing this. What am I trying to do with this? What am I trying to grab? Is this my story? Like, it so much came out of that. And I don't know that he even necessarily remembers that happened. But for me, it was an absolute turning point in terms of my thinking about the work itself. In an earlier iteration, that particular scene was at the very beginning of the book. And as the very beginning, with then a pullback from there. And then we decided it worked better to keep it where it happened, which was close to the actual end of the whole process.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to me how that fits into your concept of the politics of gawkery. That you say on page 245 are deeply embedded in our cultural histories. And I'm wondering about if you could say a little bit more about your understanding of gawkery and how you negotiate that tension in the concept of gazes that are welcome or not welcome or inviting or not inviting.
I think, you know, when I started thinking about gawkery, one thing that I didn't talk about was actually, I was in a museum in Middelburg, which is in the southern part of the Netherlands. And they had a whole exhibit called something like Cabinet of Curiosities, of all the different things that people brought with them on voyages of the Dutch East India Company. And they had it in big chests and so on. And it was all this stuff, and I was going through it, and then there was this group of three people going through it. And because it was so quiet, I could hear all their conversation, and all their conversation made me really think about how it is that we gather the stories of others and hold on to them for ourselves to make them our stories as well. And what that means, like, on which grounds are we looking? Are we looking to claim for ourselves? Are we looking to listen? How are we looking and how are we not looking? Which made me also think also of Rosemary Garland Thompson's work in disability studies around staring and how it is that we stare and what happens when we stare and what happens when people stare back at us. Because that's what happened when this man asked me to not take the pictures. He was staring back at me rather than me staring at his house, right? So that was a moment where I had to step back and say, okay, what happens when I'm the person when suddenly the gaze is directed right back at me and I'm living with the discomfort of it.
Right.
I don't know if that answers where you were going.
Well, no, that's so interesting because I was part of something yesterday where we were talking to Susan Stryker, and Susan Stryker said that when you become cognizant of how you're being perceived by others, there's a moment where you go, how do I make sense of this? And that's part of the way she negotiates the questions that she wants to look at even further or to pursue. But going back to this idea of language and belonging, so I'm just trying to get the sense of this question because I'm afraid to try and pronounce the Dutch word. So on page 40, in the Netherlands, you could be omgeskakeld, switched over to Dutch. Yeah. But in Suriname, you do not speak Stranantongo. Whereas the woman on the canal tour rapidly speaks Surinami, claiming belonging. So I'm just wondering about how, I think what the question is getting at is the way that language might define our sense of belonging or our ability to claim belonging. And I'm just wondering on your thoughts of that relationship between belonging and language, and also what is the allure in belonging? Why is this question of belonging so big for all of us or for so many?
Well, I'd say with language, I mean, all we have to do is look at how hard Indigenous communities are working to maintain language and to recover language, because it's so tied into understandings of who they are, who we are, right? And so when I wrote omgeskakeld, and that is really how I woke up in the morning. I was like, oh, wait, I'm thinking in Dutch. It's all good. I'm here again. It all fits. And I know where I am now because omgeskakeld, I've just switched over. And then in that later point where this woman was speaking Sarmini, and I think that for her, it really was the fact that she could say those things and that she could have a conversation with this man that nobody else could have a conversation with. Right. Nobody else could have a conversation with meant that she was part of a community that nobody else was a part of. Right. And that was a way for her to, it really was important for her that was there. Right. So, and there was a radio conversation while I was there that I was listening to at one point, around the use of who was allowed to speak the Afro-Surinamese Creole and who wasn't. These two radio announcers were talking about it together, having a conversation. One of them was allowed to, one wasn't. And I made me think of my mother who wasn't allowed to and my uncle who was, and what that means in terms of your place in a community or your perceived place in a community. I guess for me, belonging, for me, it's also because everybody has always tried to ascribe identities to me. Right. So finding my own was important because so many had been ascribed to me that were fundamentally wrong.
Right. I'm just going to try and read this question directly. So this comes from Nadine. And so I'm just going to use her words. As much as this is a book about archives, it is also so much a book about place. Can you say a little bit more about the kind of learning that takes place traveling to being in a place has enabled for you, and how this articulates with unsettles the kind of learning that happens in and through the archives? So place and archives and traversing the distances between and in.
I think place is super important and how one feels in a specific place. So for example, for me, it was really important to read colonial archives in a colonized space, right? And also to think through, to feel paper in a space where it's, you know, 37 degrees outside, where you can't walk for longer than half an hour without having water in your bag because the sun is right on top of your head. And because that shapes how I read what I'm reading in the archives, right? Because it's so located in terms of these were stories that happened right here. But then also the physical environment and moving and walking through spaces gives a very embodied form of knowledge. In some sorts of ways, sometimes the archives can become very disembodied. They're sort of paper, ephemera, some kind of way. It can feel that way. But when you're walking through space, you get a sense of proportion, you get a sense of distance, you get a sense of air, You get a sense of how air moves. You get a sense of temperature. You get a sense of relationships between bodies, smell. So all the senses are on high alert when you're in place. And I think that that gives that sort of embodied engagement with what you're working with. And certainly that has become very important. I first discovered that when I was working in a research in Switzerland, when I was actually in a town that somebody was in, one of the correspondents was in, and just getting a sense of, oh, this relates to this, to this. If this person was here, they saw this building and then they saw this building. And I never would have thought about that if I hadn't been in that particular place, right? So it gives a different sense of, the knowledge is in the body more than it is entirely only in your head.
Right. So I apologize if I haven't been able to get to everyone's question. I'm just very conscious of the time. So before we do the door prize draw, so Aman, be ready. Sonia, what's next? What's next? Two next. So what's next for you? What are you working on now? And also, I noticed that you're the co-editor of the with Marlene Cutter from York University of the Life Writing Series from Wilfrid Laurier University Press. And I'm just wondering what's coming up with them. So for you and for the series that you're editor of.
So here's my plug for Wilfrid Laurier University Press. The staff, from the senior editor to the PR person, marketing person, they're all fantastic. They're really great to work with. So even if you don't work in life writing, if you work in other areas, they're really great. They're also more and more interested in hybrid work that crosses boundaries in various ways. And they're just really, they've been really wonderful to work with. Of any press I've worked with, they've been the best to work with. The press itself has a number of projects on the go. I'm not exactly sure what stage they're at. I know a number of things have been submitted. And so I can't necessarily speak to how far they are in the approval process. I know things have gone out for review of various sorts. And one is supposed to come out this fall, but it's still being presented to the editorial board. So I can't say anything, but if it comes out and it works out, it should, fingers crossed, it's a fantastic book. So I highly recommend it.
So watch the website.
Watch the website. This is something that came out. If it comes out, it's somebody who has a background in journalism, folklore, and geography. And has written a really beautiful, beautiful book and very provocative as well. In terms of my own work, honestly, after I wrote this for a while, I couldn't write anything. Like it was like my whole body and my brain just couldn't write a thing. I'm actually currently working on more of a passion project around my almost 100-year-old flute and histories of amateur music making and that particular flute in the UK in 1922. And so that allows me to play my flute too. But that was told by someone named E. Johnson. And so trying to find E. Johnson is an adventure and a half.
Oh, that's great. That sounds really exciting. So we'll all be sure to watch for both of those. Thank you. Say anything before
we Yes, already said in the chat. It's lovely to see all of you. I see some old friends in the audience. I'm so sorry we, couldn't mingle and chat. But hopefully I'll see some of you again in our future events. I plugged in our little website. We really do have a lot of exciting events coming. But I want to thank Rima and Aman for working so hard on it. And of course to Sonia for coming back to see us, visit us, and share her wonderful work with us, even if it's only virtually. But we'll have you back physically post-COVID for sure. So thanks everyone, and I hope you all have a good weekend.
Thank you so much.
Welcome the spring and the summer rain. Softly turn to sing again. Welcome the bud, the summer blooming flower. Welcome the child whose hand I hold. We are